Right, so how do you see three dimensions? That's what one does in research, getting yourself into holes. So just feel free to do that.
Maybe a coordinate system, well, a collection or equivalent coordinate systems.
Okay, so you mean by that that I have some rulers or?
Yeah, a collection or equivalent
coordinate systems.
Maybe a continuum in which matter can exist.
A continuum in which matter can exist. So, but then that means that the continuum is there, and then we put the matter in. Can the continuum exist there and depend on the matter? Okay, any more? Yes?
Yeah, network of discrete states.
A network of discrete states? States of what?
Points.
A network of points. Why a network?
Because usually you can say that one point is next to another, so you can be next to something.
So what does it mean to be next to something?
To be able to interact directly.
Okay. So I'm next to somebody if I can interact with them directly, and I'm not next to them if I don't interact.
Not directly.
Cool.
Big white thing in the sky at night.
Okay. Do you see the big black thing?
You see the things in the big black thing.
You see the things in the big black thing, right? So, again, is the black thing there when the things are not there?
There's probably things in the black thing you can't see, but it's still there.
There's still a thing.
You can't see.
Okay. All right, let's move to another easier topic. So what is past and what's future? So how do you know that something is past or something is future? How do you know that?
Because life has come us from the past and we came from us to the future.
Okay.
And if life can't reach out from, it is no past and no future, it's something else.
Okay. So then when you come here and hear my talk and then you go out and you say I've heard the talk, right? The talk is gonna be in your past. How exactly does that work? So let me do that step by step. I'm gonna give a talk to you. So I'm sitting here, right? That's me and my screen. And what happens is, well, stuff happens. So photons come out of the screen, and I guess sound waves come out of me. So that's, if you want, my light on, moves up, and it keeps going, and then it reaches you. So the blue dot is supposed to be you. So at some point, what I just said comes to you, right? Then you say, okay, it's happening. So there is a physical process that you use to say that something has happened to you. There is something hitting you, right? So, since light is the fastest way that I can communicate with you, and when I communicate with you, then something happens, then things become your past, then what we say is that light comes, we structure. What happens to light is what determines your past and future. Yes? So if you consider everything around you that you ever communicate with, and all the ways that you communicate with it, and you keep track of it, that is essentially what your past is. So what's this picture? Have you seen this picture before?
Yeah.
Okay. So you know what it is, right? So you know that... That's right. So in case somebody has missed it, this circle of stuff here, all of these are multiple images of the same galaxy which is behind this galaxy, right? And what you're taking a picture of here is the fact that gravity bends light. So there is this massive stuff in the middle, and the galaxy that is behind, the light that comes out gets better. And so you end up seeing it many times. So all the light rays that would have just gone elsewhere come to you. So now this is interesting, because that pretty means that I could actually use gravity to affect things like past and future. What will become past, not change the past, but what is the past really depends on gravity. So how could it be that I could arrange for you to come here for this talk? I also come here and I give the talk, but you walk out of the room and you said that there was no talk. You see no talk. I'm here, you're there, there is no talk for you. It's an easy thing to do. Yes?
If I get out of the room before the information comes to me.
That would work, but my rule is that you stay in the room, we all stay in the room. And there's still, you still think that no talk.
If you put a black hole there.
Yes, good. So you put a black hole behind the screen, which seems some of your electrical physicists it's an easy thing to do, then all the light will just go in. It will never come out of you. So you won't see me. So I could be here, you could be there. Nothing happened. So you could actually wonder what that means, right? Are we actually really close to that situation? Are we, as you were saying, next to each other if we didn't interact? Okay, so that's you not seeing my talk. So gravity and past and future are connected. You can use the one to affect the other. So that is basically what general relativity is saying. So you can describe what GR is, general relativity. Pretty easily. What Einstein said about space and time is that only events are physical. A notion of like a meter is not fundamental in any way. What is important is what happened. Did something hit you? Did you detect something? If you did, then there are notions of past, future, space, distance that you can reconstruct from that. If you didn't, then you have nothing. So any coordinates that you might use to describe events have no inherent physical meaning. 3 meters doesn't mean anything in any fundamental way. But that something was detected by you does mean something. That's a real thing. So the way that this translates, which I don't know if you have discussed in this school, is that if you think of space and space-time as a geometry, then that geometry is dynamical. So you can change it. So I can, by moving matter around, I can change the geometry, which actually means that I can change what is before and what is after. Or another way to say that is matter curves space-time, and space-time tells matter where to go. So these two things are connected. Okay, now we move on to quantum theory.
Oh, yes.
Oh, no.
That's true.
It's not you.
So you've done a double slit experiment?
Yes.
And it seems that I shoot, I don't know, electrons or something from my laser gun through two slits, and instead of seeing just electron, I don't know, bullet holes, on the other end of the slits, I instead see an interference pattern, right? And the very intuitive explanation for that is that the electron took all possible paths to get from here to there, including, I mean, it can go around the moon, it can go through all sorts of interesting stuff. So if you ask the question of where the electron was between here and there, then the answer is that it was everywhere. You should have a problem with that. But I'm going to concentrate on a very specific problem that this leads to. So now, the electron here can be here and not here at the same time, right? So the electron being everywhere, another way to say it is that if I pick a point here, then and I ask, is the electron there? Then the answer is yes and no at the same time. So now if we go back to what we had before, what if I, and fundamentally the black hole is a common thing too. So now what happens if the black hole behind here is there and not there? It's a mind-bending session, this one, right? Okay, so I now have a black hole that is there and not there. So what happens?
Yes,
I did.
We hear the talk.
Exactly. Yes, you hear the talk, and you don't hear the talk.
Right.
So that's really what happens if you put quantum theory and GR together, right?
Oh.
Which, so you can have two additives here. Boom. Or there's something wrong. If you think that you have a good understanding of what it means for something to happen and not happen at the same time, then that's fine. But I don't. So I'm troubled by all of this. I guess you are not happy either. Yes, I figured. So the point is this, that when you do quantum theory, you think it's weird. But when it comes to what quantum theory says about space, it's usually very straightforward, so the electron can do all sorts of funny stuff, but it lives in a lab. And the lab is always, we never consider the environment in the sense of the space in which the quantum stuff is happening. This is always separate. Because if it wasn't, then you would have a problem. So every time you do an interference experiment in the lab, then in some way you're curving, you're changing the room that the lab is, that the electron is in. So you end up, if you want, the space-time in which your electron lives would go into quantum superposition. The actual room itself would do that, which is a problem. So if you want, quantum theory and general relativity say pretty different things about space. So quantum theory, so you can ask, what is the path of a particle? And relativity tells you the usual thing, that it's the shortest one. If you ask what path does something take, it says the shortest, everything is lazy. But quantum theory tells you that it's all possible simultaneously. And these two things are very different. So general relativity and quantum theory are either incomplete or incompatible. They tell you very different things about space time. So which one is true? Or is there a way to make a new theory that somehow combines both? So one idea you can have is quantum theory and general relativity are wonderful, but they have limitations. Like they only go so far. So they break down eventually. So general relativity predicts there are black holes, but it doesn't tell you what happens inside a black hole. I'm not going about whether you crush or squeeze. It's just what is a black hole. What it tells you is that you have an infinite gravitational field, but when you have an infinity, basically what it means is that you don't know. So it doesn't. You basically don't know what a black hole is. You just know that they're there. Then, if you quantum theory or quantum field theory describes matter, but it tells you funny things like if I have a photon, then it could spontaneously decompose into an electron and a positron pair. And then the electron can emit another photon, which can decompose into an electron and positron pair, which can emit a photon, and it can keep going. So here you have an infinite sequence of these things again. So you have an infinity. And you know how to deal with this, but again, it means you don't know what's going on. Another thing is, well, quantum theory itself, it's not really something that we really understand. So we all know how to use it, and we're used to it. But I don't think anybody is particularly happy with what it means for things to go through everything at once and be here and not here. So what all of these things have in common is that what what goes wrong in our understanding is when you consider the effects of quantum theory and space together at the same time. Right? What you're doing here is that you're probing the structure of space at the very small. And it all goes weird. So, then what you say, well, these two theories can only go so far, and you need a new theory, a quantum theory of gravity. Which we don't have. We have different attempts at that. And I'm going to discuss something. So, okay. First of all, when you talk about a theory, you have to ask the question of what is this relevant scale of the theory? Where does it apply? So you know that, for example, quantum theory describes the small, and relativity describes the big. So what should quantum theory describe? So the way you answer this question is you say, yeah, so it's when do the quantum effects of space become relevant? What energies? What
there are high energy in a
closed
space.
Yes. So how small?
By the
way. Okay, so you get the answer by standard things called dimensional analysis. You basically put together the constants that govern the theories that are your ingredients, that is GR and quantum theory. So H bar is Planck's constant telling you how important quantum effects are. G is Newton constant telling you how important gravity is, and C is the speed of light, and there is only one way to combine them to give you a length scale. And that is insanely small, 10 to the minus 35 meters. That's where the quantum effects of space should be really, really important. Now, if you want to get a hang of that, is if I compare the size of the Earth to a nucleus, that's the same ratio as comparing a nucleus to quantum gravity. So that should bother you, because that really means that given that our experiment kind of probes somewhere to here, trying to understand what the physics here is really would be like somebody saying that I would like to understand atoms by measuring lakes and mountains. That is one of the problems that we are facing. But we, you know, there are always ways around these things if you are inventive enough. Okay, so then let's go back to what is space. So how about what is space made of?
Made of threads.
Threads.
Yeah,
imagination. It's a fabric to be inside and put it together. Okay. That's made of threads. Describing what?
So
there's a lot of vectors around.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, cool. So if I ask, like, what is matter made of?
We don't know. To a certain extent.
It's made of super shapes.
We're not sure.
So just give me something to get going.
Super shapes. A really big black thing in the sky.
Okay, I got you. All right, so let me just see. Maybe you can survey, right? So matter is made of atoms. More or less. I'm not too fussy here. I just want, like, the rough features and stuff. So let's just say matter is made of atoms. So then let's just me try by analogy, right? I don't know very much, so what I know from here, I'm gonna put it there. So let me just say, well, matter is made of atoms. Is space made of atoms? Atoms of space.
Whoa.
Okay, I'm gonna try that. So atoms of matter look like this, right? You have a box of it has a gas inside, and it has like the molecules or the atoms of that gas moving around. There is a table, and that's the atoms in the table. Okay, does this work? If I want now to, can I use the same picture for atoms of space?
Sure.
A bunch of billiard balls moving around.
No.
Yes.
Exactly. So what do I move the atoms in?
The universe.
Oh, you just have to make them so small that
try to
make
them more large.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Alright. So if I just have like a bunch of billiard balls moving around, then you need the billiard table for the billiard balls to move around. And then the bigger table itself would be the space that they move around in. But I want to make the space out of the space. So bigger balls in the space is not a good enough way to make space out of something, right? Because I've already put it in. But maybe something I could use is the notion of near neighbors, or who interacts, who does not, directly, relationships. So that is a model that a lot of people are using for atomic structure of space. So this is a network, and it's not supposed to be anywhere. This is one way to draw it. I could draw it in any other way. The only thing that it matters is who is connected to whom, right? So for example, you would think that you have one link between two nodes of the network. That means that they interact directly. You have two links here. It means they interact with some help, not a lot of help, et cetera, right? And so it's only the relations of these things that matter. Now, why atoms? Why do you say that this structure is somehow atomic? And the point with atoms is that you can somehow count their discrete things, right? You have one, two, three, four. And so in fact, if you analyze these guys, then you can also count. So you have a notion of area that is associated with these graphs. So if you have, so the graphs, by the way, can be labeled. That means, usually what that means is that you have a little spin sitting on each graph, but it doesn't matter. There is a bit of something on the edge of a graph. And then you have a notion of an area. So I have a big graph sitting around here. And so if I pick up, I don't know, a sheet of paper or something, then there are edges of the graph cutting through my sheet of paper. And each edge contributes an amount of area to my sheet of paper, which has a simple formula. This is the Planck area, that's 10 to the minus 35 squared, times a number that depends on the label on the edge.
What represents the label of the edge?
What?
What represents the label of the edge?
You mean what is a label?
Why the label edge?
Why? You don't have to. You don't have to. So if you didn't, then every edge would just give the same amount. There are different models, and different ones have different labels. So in the simplest case, every edge just gives a Planck length squared. In more intricate cases, you could have, like, if you want fatter edges and thinner edges, I guess that's what this means. But it doesn't matter. These came from, I mean, they have a history. Things kind of come from somewhere, and they inherit stuff. The problem that you always have, which is what makes you talk of these things as atoms, is that you have discreteness. So in order to go from a smaller area to a bigger area, I have to stretch enough to include one more edge. But I cannot change infinitesimally. I only go in steps. So either I got on my sheet of paper one new edge or not. So if I did one new edge, then I have this much area from this edge, and this much area from the other edge. So the area goes in steps, which is what you think of a discrete structure to be. So then you have a picture of some sort of atoms of space where I could draw a network, or I could draw a bunch of just surfaces, areas, connected. And then that can change. So if the way I'm describing space is the connectivity of a graph, then what can happen as time goes on is that that connectivity changes. And you can describe how that works. So if this is a state of space now, and then it moves to a later state of space, then I can think of this as having happened with moves. So I have a big network, and it just pops. So this piece here changes into that, and this piece here changes into that, and eventually the whole network changes into another network. And you can make a theory out of this, because there's only so many things that can happen. Networks are very simple things. So I could give you rules that generate changing networks. So I could tell you that this just goes to that, and I can give you a probability for this to happen. And then I have a whole story of changing space, described as changing networks. And so once now I have these histories of changing graphs of space, what I really have made myself is a model of atoms of space-time, where an atom of space-time is a change in the graph. Right? That little piece of the graph goes into something else. So I hope this is all perfectly clear.
Oh, okay.
Good. I thought that would work. So, do I really think the world is networks that change? That if you had a huge microscope and you looked in empty space, you see networks that change?
Works. If it works, yeah.
Right. So I'm a physicist, which means I'm an opportunist, right? I don't, there are times to have principles and times to just see if something works. So the important thing with these things is that you think of them as models. So they're supposed to be models of space-time. And you have to keep track of this. This is a very important thing in physics. Physics makes models of the real world, right? So you have a magnet, and a magnet is a very complicated thing if you ask what it's made of. It's made of atoms, and atoms are fuzzy stuff. You can hardly take a picture of an atom. But when I want to make a model for a magnet, it's a very simple thing to do. I just make a lattice, and I imagine that in every node in this lattice, there lives a little arrow that can be up or down. So instead of having complicated atoms, I just have an up or down arrow. And when they're all up, then you say it's magnetized, and when they're randomly distributed, then you're not magnetized. And it turns out that this very simple thing describes a magnet pretty well. But you don't really think that there are arrows inside a magnet. So it's pretty similar with that. This is a space-time, and this is a model for a space-time. So what this is, it's a picture of one-dimensional network circles, just changing in time. And people make computer models of that, analyze it, and they have a notion of what a dimension means intrinsically in such a system. So, now, what do you do with a model? Now, how do I check that I have a good model? So, I have ways to check that a little arrow's model for a magnet corresponds to a magnet. How do I check that a bunch of networks correspond to a space-time? So, I don't actually know that they do, but I want to discuss how do you do that? How would you go about that? So, this is current research. So it's interesting to go back to a long story of the actual story of the atoms, when people were wondering, are there atoms of matter? And they didn't, that was an open question in the 1900s. So some people said matter has to be atomic. It's an old idea, it goes back 2,000 years or something. But in the 1900s, it kind of came up. And some people were making models of it, and other people were saying it's stupid question. So all of these intelligent people were thinking about it. And then you had basically two opinions. You had The guys have actually made models of atoms, very specific. They had vortices, billiard balls, whatever. Everybody had their favorite one. And then they were engaged in telling each other, mine is better than yours. So Boltzmann's description of all those guys was basically every Tom, Dick, and Harry felt himself called upon to devise his own special combination of atoms and vortices, and fancied in having done so that he had cried out the ultimate secrets of the Creator. So there were the guys that had their favorite models, and they loved them. And then there were the others, who opposed any hypothesis on the macrostructure of matter on the grounds that, A, such a structure would be inherently unobservable, and B, our phenomenological theories are quite adequate for the legitimate purpose of science. So that means we don't think you're ever going to be able to see atoms, and B, so what? We have theories that describe everything well enough. That's really what that means. Phenomenological theories means it's not fundamental, it's effective. So maybe there are, more fundamentally, there are atoms, but I can do everything with the theories I have. Thermodynamics is what they had at the time. So they were not really bothered about whether atoms really exist or not. And that's a pretty end result. It's actually really funny because within 2 years, people went from thinking that this is an absolute abstract question of no real significance, being convinced that atoms exist. And, you know, we're not going to discuss what the consequences for that has been for our world. So how did it happen? Well, these arguments about do you have vortices or do you have billiard balls didn't work for anybody. What happened was that Einstein figured out something very simple. Actually, I think it's my favorite thing of what Einstein has done. So it's really simple. It says, okay, let me imagine I have a box with a gas. And then I have a test molecule that I, or a test something that I shoot through this. Now, if the gas is a continuous thing, then you know that the distance your blinking test particle will cover is proportional to time. While if the gas is made of atoms, then it's going to bounce off. And what you have here is a random wall, so the distance would be proportional to the square root of time. So even if I don't have a microscope good enough to look at the atoms, I can just measure the time it took for my little blinking thing to go in and out. And if I find it to go like the square, if I find the distance to go like the square root of time, then I know that atoms exist. And it's very simple, and it doesn't actually matter whether the atoms are billiard balls or vortices or anything. What goes into this is basically one thing, that they're indistinguishable. So it's a statistical statement that all atoms are indistinguishable. So when he came up with that, then somebody went in the lab and checked, and then suddenly people knew. And you know, Boltzmann, the guy that was kind of concerned about people not agreeing, the story is that he kind of killed himself because he just thought, sold that up. And he thought that they would never get anywhere with that. So, you know, you have to look for the right thing to get it. And so there are similar things here. So you can make models, and you can discuss the features of the models, but then you have to look out for experiments. And there are some analogies. So, for example, one proposal for an experiment goes like this. I can look for gamma rays, that's photons coming out from the very far, far, far end of the universe. And photons have a size. So high-energy photons are actually small. They have a short wavelength. And low-energy photons are big. They have a long wavelength. So now, if the spacetime is not continuous, but discrete, bumpy, if you want, then what you would see is big photons would just roll over and not see anything, while small ones would just bounce around. And it turns out that even though the Planck scale is very small, even though these gaps is 10 to the minus 35 meters, these photons come from so far that this effect accumulates. And so people are making predictions for what upcoming experiments might see. what would be the discrepancy between the arrival of low energy and high energy forward stars. So the networks might be, might or might not be there, but it's always important to extract the relevant part of that from for physics and try to compare it with something you can see, and then you move on. Okay, but then of course you want to develop the theory as well, and then there's a whole bunch of open problems out there that people are working on, so I'll try to mention a couple. So one of it is, how do the networks grow? So if you have a network, and then it changes in time, or rather, time is a change of that network, then you want some rule for how that would happen. Or you want to know, does it matter, what rule you pick? So this is an open question that is being looked at. Then the other thing is, one network, this quantum theory you're talking about, so one network is supposed to be one state of space. But just like the electron is here and not here, then you actually have a superposition of network at any given time. So if you think that you have quantum space, then you're talking about superpositions of this notion of adjacency that the network is, which makes things again confusing. So you've got to clear something out, but it's confusing. So this is, it's a big open debate whether you should consider superpositions of networks or not. So roughly speaking, there are three possibilities. One is you have straight quantum theory of graphs, in which case you have superpositions of graphs. But then it's confusing because you're not necessarily better off than things having happened and not happened, so now you have things being close and not close. Or there is one graph, not a superposition, that is not confusing, but then which graph? How do you, it's like, how would I find what graph the world really is? Or maybe it doesn't matter which graph, any graph could describe space well enough. That's an interesting thing. So it often happens in physics that it doesn't matter which choice you make. For example, it happens in thermodynamics. I can describe again a box with a gas inside. It doesn't matter where the atoms are. It doesn't matter what the configuration is. If I'm only talking about the thermodynamics of this gas. So maybe it doesn't matter, but then you'll have to figure out why it doesn't matter. So anyhow, we are trying to figure out what's going on there. And then that gets you into some deeper questions, trying to understand what all that means. So basically what the lesson from Einstein's theory is that the real meaning of space-time is it's a set of ordered physical events. So this is a picture of a particle physics collider outcome. And you see these paths here, and you understand these are particles of certain charges. But the reason that we can take such a picture is that each bit in this picture is actually a physical interaction. So it's the same idea as just shooting a charged particle through something that's ionized. Just you see what happens, then you see the path. Or otherwise, you infer the path. So there is no such thing as paths in the abstract. There's just a pattern. So what one says is that a physical event is a coincidence, but it's a coincidence of what persists. So the idea that I interact with you presupposes that I and you are actual persisting existence in this world. Right? If we only kind of came to be and then disappeared for just this one interaction, then it's actually not a very useful notion, that event. Well, if we have been here, if we are persisting, then you know what you're going to do. And that is a complicated story with these networks, because when you have a network, you don't have a very good idea of what a persisting thing is in that. That goes under the scientific name of thingy. Thingy is something that is a structure that stays there for long enough for you to be able to reconstruct the space out of that. So, in general, if you start with something as abstract as a graph, there is no particular reason why thingy should exist. And you have to come up, this is the same thing as wilder conservation laws of any kind. You have to have a reason for these things to be there. Okay? And similarly, what makes space stable? So now I have, if you think of space as something evolving, then why does it actually stay there? So it's a useful analogy once you have networks that evolve. You could think of them, and people do, as a computation. So you have a network, and then the evolution of the network is the same computing. But then you can see what your problem is. Your problem is that in a generic computation, you can crash. And the universe doesn't actually crash. It seems to be that space is a very stable thing. It seems to be that it's easy to get it. It looks the same everywhere. And I can't make it go away in an easy way. So there has to be a very good reason for that to be true. Okay, so that space exists. So I guess I'd say I don't think so, or I have no good reason to think so. So all I know that exists is what hits me. Right? So I'm here, and I think of myself as just a surface on which stuff comes. Do I really know that something is there? I don't. It's not as if I see there. I just see things that hit me, and I infer it came from there. So if you really think about it, I don't actually know. I have no good way, and I don't even know what could be a good way to make sure that space really exists. If I could answer the question of why do we all seem to think it does, then that would be the same thing as understanding what quantum gravity is. So when we get down in these directions, somebody sent me yesterday the cover of a book, quantum gravity being real. I guess it's a good. This is apparently what would happen after the quantum bomb in 2015. So before I close this off, I want to answer two questions that a bunch of people have asked me when I'm out there for lunch. One is, are there any women in here? Yes. I didn't have to look too hard to find a few. So this is, I found only awful pictures of all of them. So don't tell them. So this is the woman in here. Catherine does quantum gravity as well. She's originally Austrian, but she seems to have been all over the world, mostly in the United States. And she said that I should tell you that her physics teacher was pretty bad, and she doesn't really know why anybody would pick physics, judging on what high school is like, which seems to be everybody's opinion, that physics is just really great after you've had your degree. So we don't really know why anyone picked it. Roland is a grad student in string theory. I think some of you have her as a mentor. Eleonora, she's still a grad student in Rutgers, but she spends a lot of her time here. She's about to finish her PhD, and she's in string theory. Bianca does quantum gravity, and she does research here. She's here for 3 years. And Sabine, she is moving here from Santa Barbara. She does particle physics phenomenology, accelerator stuff. And Eugene, I didn't find a picture of, because she's gone off to China, and I don't know where she is, so... That's right. And the other question that I got asked is, how did I end up here? So I thought that you and I grew up in Athens. I grew up in Athens. So I finished school there. There was no physicist around. My parents are sculptors. So I grew up in a sculpture studio, which is a pretty messy place. I like just about anything. I didn't really think about physics until I was 17, when I walked through the wrong door somewhere in Athens. And it turned out, so the school system in Greece is a bit weird. And you have, at some point, they don't really teach you what you need to know to get into the university, because everybody's supposed to go to an evening private school on top of school and learn something proper. So I was looking for such a private school, and I walked through the wrong door. And it turns out there they were teaching A-levels to prepare you to go to England. And I liked the whole idea. And the guy there said, well, you have to decide what you want to do. And I said, okay, how about we put down theoretical physics? And you know, he assured me that I can change. So I thought it was fine. And indeed, I could change. I had many chances to change. So anyway, so I left Greece. And I went to England, to London. And there I did my undergraduate. And when I was in my last year as an undergraduate, I had this good friend who was a year ahead of me. So he had gone to a different college, Imperial College. And he said, there is this guy that teaches this great course on quantum theory. And it was on Friday afternoons, one of the lectures, and that was close where I lived. So I went there. And he was great. And it turned out that he was eventually my supervisor for my PhD. In the beginning, I didn't ask to do quantum graphics. This guy did quantum graphics. That's Chris Ashen. I didn't try to do that because the professors at my undergraduate university, they all were particle physicists and thought that you have to be a particle to do quantum gravity. And they were discouraging, to say the least. Well, in fact, they told me to do biology, so I guess. Could have been a good idea. So anyway, so I started doing my PhD in phenomenology, and then I switched after a year to quantum gravity. That was great. So I graduated. But I didn't actually go to the graduation because I went off to Penn State for a few years. I did a postdoc there. I actually started working with some people from Penn State while I was still a graduate student. I did some research with them. I had some ideas, and it turned out that I could do that with them. So then eventually I went there for 2 years. Then I went back to London for another year. And then I went to Berlin, where I was supposed to stay for 2 years. But after about 6 months, I met this guy that was visiting the institute, and I had a coffee with him, and he said, well, somebody in Canada has given $100 million for a theoretical physics institute. And I thought that he was a sociologist making a study of the reaction of physicists to such a... You couldn't give any names of who was the guy with the money or but I had a nice discussion. I thought I would just tell people what I think and how I really think an institute should be like. And it turned out that he was real, which was really bizarre. So and it was a bit scary because it sounded fantastic. On the other hand, there was nothing here. And I love Berlin. And, you know, Berlin versus Waterloo, Berlin is cooler. So I didn't really know, but there is just basically, I mean, if it worked, there would have been no better place to be, and it worked. So I came to Canada. And I've been here for 5 years, and it's great. And I love this place. And I don't know what happened.
From the parking lot above, there's something written in Greece. What does that mean?
Yeah, I have an issue with that. It means that nobody that doesn't know geometry may enter. And apart from the fact that it's pretentious and silly, I have an issue because I don't think geometry is that fundamental. And so I'm just trying to make that irrelevant.
Into the phrase list over Platon.
Yeah.
You got like a little blurb on you, and it said that you were interested in like neuroscience and stuff like that. So were you actually considering like changing fields?
Well, okay, that That's another question. So, let's put it this way. Quantum gravity is actually pretty tough. And the questions are difficult. And there is another issue with it, which is it actually real physics? So far, there has been no conventional experiment. And if there continues to be none, I would say it's not real physics. That was the issue that my undergraduate professors had. This is not real physics. And I think there's a point to that. So I'm doing it because I think there could be real physics. And if you have the right attitude, you'll find it. If it doesn't work out, what do I want to do? I don't think I want to be, 60 and still trying to do this. So you really want to do it, and then you want to tell yourself that if it doesn't work out, you'll just do something else. If I do something else, I don't think I want to do something else in physics. Because this is just so interesting. I think anything else will just not live up to it. But there are other interesting things out there, like, it's very hard to become a neuroscientist, right? So the point is that there is a lot of interesting things out there. And I really like thinking that I could just not do that. It helps kind of keep a straight head.
Yes. So if there probably isn't space, then where does that leave time? It's just like the passage of matter, or?
Yeah, that's a good question. Right, so the honest answer is I have no clue. That is one of the things that seem extremely confusing. So here's what I can say, is that it's easier to think of space not being fundamental. It's very hard to think of time not being fundamental. Because I can say space is not fundamental, it's just stuff that happens. But by saying that stuff happens, then I have some notion of time. So in some sense, I've got no idea how to think of the world without time. One thing that could happen, so I'm not so sure if what I'm saying makes a lot of sense, but is that there are two notions of time. That there is a fundamental time that, say, runs the network. And then there is an effective notion of time that goes into the space-time geometry. And the two might not be the same. So this would be like saying that the time that you use in general relativity is more like a thermodynamic effective quantity. So there are possibilities there, but basically this is a very good question, and that's part of what it is that we are researching. So the way that people go about it is try to make a model and try to understand what's going on, but it tends to be pretty confusing.
It should not be a network that does not evolve in time, because time is inside the network. Like, you represent in general relativity as a hyper-hyper surface, so a hyper-hyper network, say.
Yes, so that is actually one of the approaches. So you have a space-time network. So this is it's one-dimensional version of a network, which is this ping pong I was describing. And then, if you like, things don't happen on that. So there are technical ways of actually implementing what you just said. So that's a possibility, that there is no external time. The problem with starting with a system that has a time inside it is that then it becomes pretty hard to compare it to experiment, because an experiment is always a time outside. In fact, that's a problem with general relativity as well. You don't compare straight general relativity. You compare very specific solutions to that, like Minkowski space, to experiment. If the full theory that has internal time, there is no clear way in comparing that with experiment. But yes, so it might be that that's how it is. Yes?
What is it about quantum gravity that draws you to it over other areas of physics?
I guess I like questioning things. and I like trying to think, it's not as if that's what I want to do. I'll come back to this in a second. So one way to answer this is that you end up questioning the very basic things that you have. Like, do I really see what I see? And I enjoy that. Now having said I enjoy that, I also hate that. So I don't really know what the answer is. It contains, basically, you have to understand what the essence of quantum theory is, what the essence of relativity is. So if you really, really fancy understanding what the deep stuff about our theories are, there's no better way than working in a field that pushes them to the limit. Having said that, it's pretty hard. So then, half the days I just hate it for the same reason. But it's just, I wish it was just straightforward, like just do a calculation and know what I'm doing.
All right, let's give Pushkin a big round of applause. Because I think I saw a few more hands going up. So if you guys can clean off your whiteboards, you'll have those in front of you. Clean this off. Pass them down the end of the rows.
Take the calculators, please.
And you can have those as well. And go ahead and lunch.
Hi, guys, you're not going to be in here this afternoon.
Okay.
It's going to be used for other purposes, so. Thank you.